Borrowing Power and House Prices, Part 2. In our last episode, we went through how house prices changed in Sydney between 2017 to 2022 and showcased that each time property price direction changed up and down, borrowing power changed too. That is one very interesting dynamic that we are unpacking in this series and in our latest ebook released just recently on our website. Now we're going to go through the anomaly year, 2023. What on earth happened? This relationship completely broke down. Borrowing capacities indeed fell in 2023 after 5 more rate rises. Our modeling suggests borrowing capacity fell by nearly 10%, while house prices actually went the other way and rose by 10%. That's pretty crazy change in house price dynamics that's made it increasingly unaffordable for people to go and borrow and purchase a home, particularly young Australians. In this episode, we're going to go through 2023 and come up with an explainer for it. We're going to go through history and showcase why house prices and borrowing power are very, very closely correlated in some circumstances and what circumstances can lead to differences. Curtis, how are you?
Excited to go through this one because, like you say, this is a bit of the anomaly year.
Yep.
Where a lot of, to be honest, the most interesting aspects of the relationship between borrowing power and house prices could be unpacked. So, yeah, keen to go through it.
Yeah, definitely. I call it the year that many, many experts got it wrong. 2023 was a year that we began the year looking at predictions that people had. And across the board, most of those who look at financial metrics and data like we do, they came up with the analysis that house prices would fall on the back of higher interest rates and whatnot. But house prices rose materially. You could even call it a little mini boom with, you know, double digit house price appreciation here in Sydney. And effectively, all of the house price falls that occurred in 2022 have already been unwound, and we're back pretty much at peak property prices here in Sydney and across many capitals. So, Curtis, can you explain through how people are actually purchasing in this environment? If debt size is going down, what's going on? How is it actually working?
Yeah, so I think to start with, it's probably useful to pose the question, does the fact that, like you say, borrowing powers went down in 2023, but house prices went up,
yep,
do we think that represents a fundamental break in the correlation between these two figures? So, you know, these two things aren't related anymore and aren't going to be related into the future.
Yep.
Or do we think that there's a series of relatively one-off circumstances or circumstances that are perhaps unique to 2023 that have produced this kind of anomaly result,
yes,
but potentially, you know, in the long run, we expect things to go back to that kind of correlation that existed before. So
very important questions.
Yeah, I think our view is probably the latter, that there are some one-off or unusual circumstances about 2023 that have produced a bit of an unusual result.
Yes. So many data metrics. It's not only borrowing power, confidence levels as well. Like consumer confidence levels are very low, which is usually a lead indicator of a house price direction. But that was very low, yet house prices rose. So some of the COVID data mix-ups and anomalies have sort of created a new sort of order here. And it's really worth unpacking that exact question, because in our next pod, we're going to be talking about what's going to happen in 2024. We're going to predict out changes to borrowing capacity and showcase our modeling. And we need to understand how this research actually feeds through to the markets to be able to work out how relevant this research is. If borrowing powers change, does it actually equate to changes in the market? So yeah, looking at 2023, where the link wasn't close and broke, essentially, is really, really important in understanding why.
Yeah. So let's unpack it a little bit. So, like you say, one of the key factors in how people are purchasing, we've got asset prices going up,
yep,
but we've got borrowing powers going down, which effectively means on the ground, when you're purchasing a property, your funds to complete are kind of coming from two sources. You're getting some money from the bank and you're bringing some of your own money, whether that be cash, whether like cash savings, whether it be a gift from family, or whether it be, for example, equity in another property. You're providing something aside from the new bank lending to go towards the purchase. And what we're seeing in 2023 is the circumstances are that the borrowing power, i.e. the loan amounts that people can get, are are falling a little bit, but the house, the value of that they're purchasing at is going higher, which means people are in a position where they're contributing a larger equity stake in the purchase than they were previously to essentially cover that difference. And like you say, how they're purchasing, can that equity stake can come from a few different sources. And we have some thoughts on that, which we might unpack. But like I say, it can be, you know, equity from other properties. It can be equity from, you know, parents' properties, yep, or it can be just increased levels of your own cash savings. But one way or another, that is how people are purchasing and essentially covering the spread.
Yeah, it makes sense. You can either purchase with equity or debt. And if debt volumes are going down, or the amount you can borrow is falling, but prices are going up, the gap increases, which means that you need to come up with a larger equity contribution. That is the short summary there. Is that correct?
Yeah. Explaining that
correctly, right? So, Kurt, you just touched on potential explainers here. I know you've just done a little bit of research on the value of properties and the total amount of equity and wealth that Australians carry, and how that's changed in the preceding years to 2023, in the 5 years preceding. You mind just unpacking that a little bit? Because I think that is such a huge part of the story of how people are purchasing in 2023.
Yeah. So I think when we, because we see applications all the time, our kind of instinct on this is that people haven't magically got their hands on double or triple the savings, cash savings that they had, you know, from 2022 or 2021 overnight. So this ability to generate the extra equity that's going into their purchases is coming from majority coming from another source. And what we typically see, and what I've done a little bit of research and pulled the data on, is that equity is essentially coming from an uplift in property values that have happened over the last, say, 4 or 5 years. So to give you a bit of a guide, when they're at the kind of total value of residential real estate in Australia kind of bottomed out around March 2019, it was about $6.65 billion.
Yep. But after the 15% fall we covered last.
Correct.
So, yep.
Yeah. But then if we take that to today, the most recent one that was released is the September 2023 quarter. The total value of residential like real estate in Australia is $10.25 billion. So we're talking about a $3.6 trillion change, which is essentially like a 50% uplift. In residential asset values.
Wow, that's nuts.
So anyone that owns property, so for a purchaser, you know, that could be if they have interest in an existing property, or if you're getting funds from parents, or you're getting funds from another source, if they own a property, there's been a huge uplift in equity positions for anyone that's owned real estate over that 2019 to 2023 4-year period, like almost a 50% uplift.
I might be putting you on the spot here, Curtis, but do you have the data to 2021? Because house prices didn't change all that much in 2022 and 2023 on balance. It's just a little bit of a fall and back up. So 10 trillion-ish?
Yeah. So March 2022 got to 10.1 trillion.
Wow.
Okay. So from March 2022, we went from 6.65 to 10.1.
So effectively, there was a 50% increase in the total wealth of, in the total value of property. And we probably don't have all the numbers here right in front of us, but that is equivalent to the entire size, roughly, of almost every other asset class. Is that right? If you add in all of our super assets, all Australian super assets, you add in all commercial property, things like that. I know residential property dwarfs that in comparison, but $3.6 trillion has been added in 3 years into effectively the wealth position of Australians, right? Is that just a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a fair summary, which like you say, in percentage terms,
50%.
So it's just as extraordinary to go, okay, over. Yep. Such a small period, there's like a 50% uplift in the equity position of people that own property or this, property in total.
This all loops back down to the charts that we showed earlier that we've got in the book as well. In the 2020 period, in that period, same period, their borrowing powers went up 50%, house prices went up 50%, and as a result, the amount of equity, the amount of wealth Australians have went up by 50%. You know, effectively, you can just model our house prices and see how wealthy Australians are, given it makes up such a large chunk of our balance sheets. Housing is the dominant sort of percentile on any sort of Australian's balance sheet, on aggregate at least.
Yeah.
So when you have such large changes and swings in house prices, you have changes in wealth positions of Australians.
Yeah. So there's a bit of an economic theory that kind of flows on from this, which is when you have such a large uplift in, you know, asset values and equity positions, what that does for the mindset, I guess, of the people who are the beneficiaries of that and the impacts then that flow onto prices. So do you want to run through a bit of that?
Yeah, for sure. So this creates, so let's call it the equity snowball, the wealth snowball. This wealth snowball that occurred during these 3 years, the COVID sort of post-shakeup period, it creates impacts to the market. If you think of it as an individual, like if you're a household and you're a family, you know, let's say you're 40 years old, you're in your income cycle, you're earning good income, you're in jobs, you're doing well. This is a huge chunk of the participants in the housing market. So if you include that group of people and now you start looking at how they are looking at their own balance sheets during this period. So they look in 2019 and they say, hey, look, sure, I can borrow really high amount. You know, I can borrow 30% more during this little period because this is the borrowing power peak period. Now, what happens over time is this household may be sitting on, say, $2 million worth of total equity, but then they look at it and they're like, oh, actually, now we're sitting on $3 million. We made $1 million without actually doing anything, by just simply being in our own home and just by paying our bills. That's probably, you know, 10, 20 years of savings that they just make up in idle, like doing nothing, just living in their own home. Now, if they own an investment property or two, then it's just a huge uplift to their balance sheet because it'll just be a multiplier of that. So these households then look at their position again and they're like, hang on, I'm doing a lot better than I thought I was. If I sell off a few assets and I make some changes, I can go participate in the market and, you know, upgrade my home or go and retake that loan that I have and start it up again because, you know, I'm young enough to be able to go and do that. It creates what I call like a second wind market. And that second wind is what may have came through in 2023, where prices began stabilizing because people started seeing value after house price falls. And, you know, people recognize in Sydney, there's a lot of Sydney-siders here who be like, house prices don't really fall for too long in this city. We've seen it. There's strong underlying demand factors. It's a growing capital. I feel comfortable investing in property. And then you look at it and be like, okay, prices have fallen a little bit. Perhaps I'll go use all this equity that I have to re-participate in the market and go and upgrade my home or, you know, pass that through to my children, for example, and let them participate in the market and get more exposure to the housing market. So that second wind is now feeding through into the economy and into the housing market from that $3.6 trillion wealth addition that we've all felt. Might even flow through to spending a little bit and make the RBA's job a little bit harder. And perhaps that's why there's been some resilience here too. Increasing interest rates is hurting those that have too much debt, but there's not that much debt as a function of total value of housing here in Australia. The total aggregate LVR is, what, 25% or something. So perhaps it's making the RBA's job a little bit harder as well with all this debt that's swelled up, with all this equity that's swelled up so quickly that's changed household balance sheets, that's now feeding through back into the market in 2023. So that's part of an explainer for why house prices began rising in 2023. So much wealth was created in the preceding years just before it.
Yeah, which would be consistent with like the 2023 results where you're seeing people participating in the property market using an increased share of equity relative to debt when they're making their purchases. So that would be consistent with that kind of result. Yeah.
Yeah, that's picked up in the LVR data as well. Like, Jarden, I love their research. Carlos, if you're listening, hello. Research there showcases that the total LVR that people are purchasing at has come down in 2023, which makes sense.
Yeah,
because they're still buying at higher values because the prices are back at their peak and be like, how am I going to fund this? I can't get the same loan amount, which means your LVR comes down, and that's feeding through into the data itself. Which is quite encouraging for APRA because it means the risk that of the loans that are being originated in 2023 are pretty low. Low LVRs, really low debt to income ratios as well, because people can't borrow as much money.
Yep.
It's adding some resilience into the portfolio that Australians have as well. So
it's an interesting one because from an LVR or financial stability perspective, like you say, there's probably some positive aspects of it. But then from an affordability perspective, it also creates a bit of a distortion in who can access housing, because the equation has moved a little bit in 2023 where you need access to equity has become increasingly valuable. And if you don't have access to equity, whether it be your own or your parents or some access to equity, it's much, much harder in 2023 to make a go of it if you're just relying on your own personal income position to access debt to get it done.
Which is
probably a bit of a new factor, which creates some, some different winners and losers than we're typically used to. And I'm not necessarily sure it's the way, if you were designing it, the way you would want it to play out, because you would probably want to reward people who have the income position.
It's got an age issue.
The equity position. Yeah.
It's an age issue, if that makes sense. It's older strands.
And a cross-generational issue too.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the bit that I don't like. Perhaps I'm veering into political opinions here, but the bit that I don't like with these sort of outcomes is it creates like a little bit of opportunity inequality that exists when people who are born to parents who own housing versus people who are born to parents who rent. There's substantial differences in wealth transfers that occur over time, which means that this equity boom that they've gone and benefited from, any homeowner's gone and benefited from, is allowing that to pass through to their children via the intergenerational transfer, which is becoming a lot more common. We'll talk about that a little bit more shortly. Versus those that are born to parents that are renting are not sitting there with, big intergenerational transfers, and they're having to pay higher prices to go and get into the market as well. They don't have access to Bank of Mum and Dad, which is the short bit here. A lot of that is limited profile of who has access, and that's probably a little bit of a dangerous sort of area of Australian society where it's just like access to opportunities is becoming a bit harder, which can be dissuading to young Australians as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I haven't done these numbers in advance, so I'm kind of doing them on the fly off the top of my head. But if you think of it like someone on, 100,000 income versus a 200,000 income, like the DTI you're getting is, four and a bit to one. So that extra 100,000 of income that they're getting maybe gets them an extra 400 in borrowing power, maybe a little bit more, but roughly.
Yep.
And that's someone who's earning double the income.
Yep.
100 versus 200, say. But if that person who earns 100,000, if they have a parent or a grandparent or anyone in their family that's, if they're a Sydney-sider, own property in Sydney from 2019, they're probably going to have, potentially access to more than $400,000 of equity uplift that's happened in the family, they might be able to access. That's just a little bit of a, even in the space of 4 years, having access to equity might have become increasingly more powerful than, your income position, basically, in terms of what you can do.
Yeah, exactly. So that can create a little bit of a divide, I guess, in society, a little bit, particularly amongst young Australians, where young Australians cannot participate in the market versus can participate in the market, at least sooner, at a different age point, I guess. Let's just say 22-year-olds, a young age group, or 25-year-olds, for example. It's hard for a 25-year-old to save a large enough deposit at these house prices versus someone who has access to parents who can provide access to fund the deposit or the guarantor.
Yeah, 100 and 200K is, to me, a good example. If you're on 100K and you've got access to Bank of Mum and Dad, and you're a 30-year-old or, in your mid-20s or something, and you're on 100K salary, and then you're kind of good to go. But if you're, same age and on a 200K salary, you've killed it, you're doing really, really well, but you don't have access to Bank of Mum and Dad, you could actually be in a worse position to try and enter the market, which is a little bit of a perverse outcome that's probably fallen out of the 2023 scenario.
Yeah, that is one downside. But on the flip side, one positive, I guess, I'm not so sure you call this positive, but what the data is showcasing, particularly when you look at bank results that are being released, is that it's higher income Australians that are going and getting loans in 2023. Makes a lot of sense. So perhaps we have not only a funding structure change, it's the who is that is getting loans has changed here. So, you know, call it, if you break up income quartiles in Australia, the first three quartiles, first 75% of Australians, less funding in total is going to them in 2023, and a greater amount is going to the top quartile, which probably represents them being able to get credit, or enough credit to go and participate, and the lower income quartiles not getting enough credit, so perhaps not even participating in the first place, which on an aggregate debt balance situation for Australia is making the aggregate debt composition a little bit stronger because it's, you know, higher income borrowers getting mortgages at lower LVRs and things like that. So there's probably a financial stability benefit from this sort of change that's happening. But it's clear that 2023 has caused disruptions in funding structures, in who is buying and how that's being bought. And it's being driven by partly the preceding years and the context behind it and the massive boom and the equity boom that's created and the second wind sort of factoring in that's come into play here. Is that just a
summary? I think so. That's our little summary of 2023 is, like you say, there's that second wind.
Yep.
You know, there's also some other factors we look at just generally for supply and demand of property.
Yep.
You know, we've seen on the demand side significant, you know, overseas migration, and on the supply side, you know, relatively few completed dwellings coming online relative to, you know, the increase in our population. So again, that's putting some upward pressure on prices. Doesn't necessarily explain the whole thing. I think the second round wealth effect, you know, might be a bigger factor there. There's a few factors all, I guess, supporting upward pressure on prices in 2023 when they really should have been going down.
Yeah, that makes sense. The fundamentals are probably the main reason here. Rents shot up, migration shot up, there was a shortage of supply of housing, which then drove demand. And sure, affordability became weaker, but on balance, there's a lot of Australians, a lot of high-income Australians. So the overall demand for housing rose through this period of time, and that caused house prices to go up. I think those are really fundamental reasons. What we're probably talking about is more side reasons and explainers for why it occurred during a period where borrowing powers fell, and how that can happen, which is really, really important. When you have like anomaly type settings where borrowing powers come down, but you have really strong demand factors outside of credit, house prices can continue to rise. 2023 was big evidence of that occurring, that credit markets are really, really important. And you still need the total value of credit to rise for property values to rise. That definitely occurred from February 2023 onwards. The debt cycle did turn around in terms of loan commitments. You still need that. But in terms of the composition of who is getting that increase, that can change. And it could be smaller loan amounts to more people or higher income people that can make up for some of those differences, which is really, really important explanations when you go into 2024 and you work out, hey, if you recycle these borrowing powers straight back up and increase it again, which is what we'll talk about in our next podcast in detail and run through our modeling there, will that translate into higher property prices? Talking this out with you, I have never like fully delved into it, but now talking this out with you, I can easily see that debt can play a larger role again. Well, that equity contribution that's been making a role in 2023 is more of a structural thing, and it will continue over time as we become richer and wealthier, that our asset position is going to make up a larger portion of our funding structure. And that is kind of like a big structural uplift. And as you start increasing debt sizes again, it could easily lead to further momentum in house price growth as well. It's not going to rewind the equity component that occurred in 2023. It's only going to add to it. That's probably what I got out of talking through this.
Yeah. You know, there was a 3.6 trillion uplift in asset value. So unless that gets unwound, like that's where the equity you know, is coming from. So
exactly.
I think that's probably a good one to unpack on our next podcast, which, like you say, is going to be running through what we expect for 2024 and how this relationship continues.
Yeah, a little preview to it. We have modeled out every change that we expect through 2024 and 2025. If you want to the pre-release, you want to delve straight into that research, jump on our YouTube channel. There's a video there with all the charts there, and you know, jump on our website, download the ebook. You'll be able to see more and more of that. We'll release these episodes pretty quickly, shortly after each other. And yeah, the full story over the past 7 years, showcasing how borrowing power and house prices, that's the research we're unpacking here. Curtis, always a pleasure, and catch you on the next one.